Hey, everybody, and welcome to Invested. I'm Danielle Towne. For our happy summer little From the Vault series. So enjoy this way back episode and happy summer.
Hey, everybody, this is Phil Towne.
This is Danielle Towne.
And welcome to the Invested podcast, where what happens?
Best podcast about mindful investing that ever existed.
We're talking about
That's
mindful investing. And Danielle's continues to try to actually have me understand what mindful investing is. While I'm trying to teach her, my daughter, how to invest like Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, Guy Spier, Manish Prabhai, and me, which would be sort of, we would call it value investing, where you try to find something and buy it for less than it's worth. That's what I guess
what we're calling it these days. You're calling it deep value investing?
Yeah, we say deep value because we get real focused on a small number of companies that we understand well. Charlie Munger, by the way, read anything you can written by Charlie Munger. He's phenomenal. Charlie is very comfortable owning three companies. Bruce Berkowitz is very comfortable owning three companies, you know, that you know are on sale and you like them and they're great companies. They're not going to go bankrupt. Warren Buffett, he has 70% of his portfolio in about five companies, and then he has a whole bunch.
So far, you're just saying people own very low numbers of companies.
Yeah, real focused, okay, that are on sale, that we really understand the value, and we're buying them cheaply. And I think we've talked about this in a previous podcast, but on sale essentially means we're buying these companies as really as if they were private companies that are available to us to own all of, right? That's kind of the price we look to pay for a public company, which typically is about half of what that public company would sell for. And the reason is because public companies have huge advantages to the big money investors. The two most important of which are that they're transparent in their information, and second, that they have a lot of liquidity in the company and they can get their $300 million back out of that thing whenever they want to, which is a big, big deal to fund managers.
Yeah.
So we want to buy
deep value as opposed to value.
Yeah, so we want to buy it as if we're going to hold it forever. And we would call it focused as well. It's sort of focused deep value. We're not looking for 10% off. You know, we're looking for 50% off. And we're not
focused.
Yeah, and we're not looking to buy 50 or 60 things. We're looking to buy, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 maybe. And in our entire lifetime, we want to buy maybe 20 companies. And then that's a very different way of investing than the way most people go at it. So we're really excited to introduce you to this.
20 in your entire life.
Yeah, your whole life, you've got 20. And the reason you would think that way is I'm going to buy 20 in my whole life, is that if you thought that way, let's say you're a millennial like Danielle is, then you would be thinking real seriously, if I'm only going to get 20 punches on this card, I really need to take my time and make sure that the first punch is a really good one. And the second one is a really good one.
Yeah.
And the third one is a really good one. And you'd realize, if you only bought one company a year, you'd be out of punches by the time you're in your middle working years. You'd be out of punches for the rest of your life. So really, if you thought about it in a linear way, and it's never linear, let's make that clear, you're not going to buy one at the average pace of one every 3 years, right? Because you'd have five companies in 15 years. You're going to wait patiently with a list of great companies. And then when the market collapses, which it's bound to do because it fluctuates regularly, then you are going to be able to pick up all five of these or seven of these all at once. Super on sale.
Focused value. Focused value.
Yeah, it's good.
It's more descriptive. It's more accurate.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
We'll use that one. So,
all right, so we've been talking about valuation for a long time, and you came up with an awesome draft checklist, which we went over the last two podcasts, and we got a few questions that are a little bit timely, so we decided to take a time out from valuation, as we are wont to do occasionally. We all need breaks We all need breaks from valuation. it's not my favorite subject. We got a few questions.
Yeah, I want to do a question from one of our listeners named Aaron Lowry, who wrote in a three-part question. I'm going to see if we can get to all of it here in the next little while. And I'm not going to go in order. So I just want to say great questions, Aaron, and everybody else who's writing them in. We'll try to get to as many as we can over time.
Write in your questions to questions@investedpodcast.com.
So one of the questions that Aaron had was that, you know, we target 26% compounded rates of return. That's our target. Manish Pabrai has 26% on his license plate, right?
No, he does not.
Yeah, he does.
Stop it. That is the nerdiest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Somebody's going to send Monash this clip.
Gosh.
Right here. I love it. I think it's great. It's a bit of the secret, right? It's like the secret, you're supposed to put this stuff on your refrigerator and look at it every day. Monash looks at his license plate every day. 26%. That's it.
I mean, nerds are running the world. I respect it.
Yep.
But it doesn't make it any less nerdy.
Well, it's quite cool. I totally agree with it.
It's like what we were talking about last time with setting up your environment for success so that it supports your values.
Exactly.
And that's, good Lord, put it on your license plate. I love it.
Exactly. I mean, it's 100% right. And I love the stuff that I keep getting in this podcast from you, Danielle, like setting up my environment. You reminded me that Guy's got Warren Buffett's picture in his office. I need to get Warren's picture in my office. I've got George Foreman's picture in my office because I was on stage once with George.
He has great grills, Dad. Don't sell him short.
I think George is a genius. I'll tell you the truth, honestly.
I met him too.
I met him a couple of times, and he's just the most real person. He's just who you see. That's what you get. A guy on a street corner, weighing 300 pounds with a big beard, pitching Jesus in Houston from a street corner. After he lost the heavyweight championship to Ali. And, you know, George was on a street corner in Houston pitching Jesus to whoever wanted to listen. And he was there at 300 pounds. He blew up. And he was 40 years old or something, 38 years old. And he had a big beard. And he would tell people, hey, how you doing? I'm George Foreman. You know, he's a friendly guy. I'm George Foreman. You know, I found Jesus, and Jesus is my savior. Because George was like the original bad boy of boxing, right, back then. There was nothing very spiritual or religious. It was 100% hardcore street warrior. And with all of the things that go with that, who lost to Ali. And it blew his mind that he lost to Ali, and he just lost himself. And he found himself in Christ. Yeah, which is a great story, right? And so here's George on a street corner in Houston pitching Jesus to whoever walked by. He says, hey, I'm George Foreman. And people are like, yeah, right. They just thought he was a street nut. You know,
was
a homeless.
Was he really famous? Like, are people supposed to know who George Foreman was?
Sure. I mean, he was the heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, oh, yeah. People know who George Foreman is.
All I know are his grills.
Well, you were just a kid back in those days. And
I don't even know when that happened. It's like...
Foreman was famous, man.
Life.
Yeah.
So anyway, famous. George Foreman is what? On your wall because you like his story?
I love his stories. I think he's one of the best public speakers I've ever listened to. Fascinating all the way. I think he's just an incredible human being. And, you know, I just really dig the guy. So I got a picture with him, and I'm very proud of my picture with George. But, you know, it's inspiring me in many ways. And George is incredibly successful. He's worth about $140 million. Sorry, George, I wasn't probably supposed to say that, but I'm saying it anyway. $140 million or so. And he's...
So make sure you say it twice.
Yeah. And he's done it on his own. I mean, the guy is absolutely a phenomenal entrepreneur. Phenomenal stage presence, phenomenal boxer. And of course, the George Foreman story that you don't know, apparently, is that he came back into boxing at 40 years old because his wife just told him, George, you don't know how to do anything else. You're the worst Jesus salesman on the planet. You know, people are terrified of talking to you about anything, much less becoming saved or something. So you're doing a terrible job. You're terrible at that. Why don't you go? And George has got like 8 kids. I got to make a living. He went back to boxing, and he re-won at, I don't know, 42 years old. Something, correct me, it's in the early 40s. He re-won the heavyweight championship of the world, which wow. nobody does. Nobody wow. does that. Yeah. I mean, his story is just like the most compelling, exciting story I think I've almost
you know
ever
what?
Heard.
I don't think that you need to take any lessons from Guy Spear about who to have on your wall. Clearly you have the right guy on your wall.
I'm pretty proud of having George on my wall.
We all got to do what's right for us, and what's right for Guy Spear is not going to be right for me, and what's right for you is not going to be right for me, and what's right for the other guy down the street may be perfect for me. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Take inspiration from where you get it and leave the rest.
Yep. So, you know, you're inspiring me to update my walls. I got to add some more cool people to George, you know, absolutely. So let's talk about Aaron's question. I mean, we wandered afield. How could we ever do that on this podcast? But we did. And what his question was is that you're projecting this 26% return and targeting it, but you're also telling us to sit in cash for long periods of time. And so what he did is he proposed, like, first the question is, how can you get a high return by sitting in cash? So let me give you a not hypothetical. This is an actual thing that happened. So Chipotle Mexican Grill is a company that I wrote about. I talked about it. And in 2008 and 2009, the price dropped, and it got down to about $49 a share and started coming back up again in the gigantic financial meltdown in 2009. Okay, so we stepped in and bought Chipotle at 55 and rode that all the way up to where it got stupidly high priced about 5 years later at 550, and we got out. So, you know, these are round numbers, they're not perfect. But $55 going in, exiting at around 550 coming out 5 years later. And then, of course, Chipotle famously went on to $700, 760, before it finally started dropping. But you know, when it gets well up into the red zone above the price, we're looking to reallocate capital. So that basically,
so
if you had done this,
had a sense that it might not go any higher.
Yeah, I didn't have any reason to think it would keep going
but
higher.
But then it did, and then what can you do?
Yeah, what are you going to do? You know, you're gonna, if you got a place to put the money, you put it someplace else. So here's the thing: if you guys knew what we're teaching you in this podcast, many of you could have made that same call in 2009 and bought that stock. Danielle, you could have done it in 2009 at $55. Now, let's say that you started waiting to put money into the market in 2004, okay?
Okay.
2004. You just started studying, and the market's going up, and everybody's telling you you should be investing in mutual funds. And you're just staying true to your learning, and you study for 5 years, and then the market crashes, all right? So for 5 years, you invest $0. All of your money is sitting in one place. Let's say you have $100,000 to invest, and it's all sitting there doing basically nothing, just, you know, making money market account rates of return. And then here you are 5 years later, and this $100,000 goes in. Now, let's say you have much more than $100,000, but you're going to invest $100,000 in Chipotle. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so like you've been sitting there just twiddling your thumbs, feeling super annoyed at how much time I've spent on this investing process. Nothing's happening. And then 3 more years go by, nothing happens. Oh, it's the worst. Okay, fine. So now we're in 2009.
So by this time, you're thinking, this is not working.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
But out of blind faith, you hang on, and son of a gun, the market crashes out of nowhere for something completely unrelated to stocks or even the companies that are in the market. It totally train wrecks, and all of a sudden, one of the companies on your list, Chipotle Mexican Grill, actually tons of them on your list, but Chipotle's one of them, go on sale, and you see this thing at $55, and you think it's on sale. So you buy it with $100,000, and then 5 years later, it's at $550 a share, and your $100,000 has become $1 million.
That sounds awesome.
Which would be pretty awesome. So it's $1 million, and you decide to get out. Now, if you didn't get out, then over the next 2 years, that would have gone up to $750 a share, which would have given you about $1.5 million. but then it crashed down to 400. So the thing finally came down to earth. So it looked like we were wise to get out at 550, okay?
Okay.
Now, that means in 2014, or 10 years later, your 100,000 that you started with in 2004 has now become $1 million. And your compounded annual growth rate per year happens to be 26% per year, including the 5 years you sat in cash.
Hmm. All right. The idea then is you wait, you wait, you wait, you wait, and then you make a home run. Is that the idea?
That's basically right. You wait, you wait, you wait, you wait, and you're waiting for this fat, fat pitch across the plate. And you're not, you're refusing to swing at anything, any even stuff lots of people swing at. You're waiting. Because why? Because when you get the pitch you're waiting for, you're going to hit it into San Francisco Bay. Okay? You're going to clobber it.
I mean, I like it, and I get it. And I get that, like, real life has backed that up. I do have to say, not everything's going to be a home run, you know? And that's why we invest in multiple companies. Yes, a small number, but still multiple. And we don't expect them all to be crazy Chipotle kind of numbers, do we?
Well, yes, we kind of strangely... Chipotle is an exception because it got on fire and just got crazy expensive. And so you end up with this really great sale down the road at 550 of a company that was probably worth 300 or something, right?
Yeah.
You still would have done really good, but this did insanely good.
Yeah.
But it wasn't alone, you know? What happens is the emotions in the market will carry the price downward on fear far lower than it should be. And those same emotions will go the other way when the market starts to get greedy and irrationally exuberant. It'll carry these prices higher than they should ever go. So, for example, Whole Foods in 2009 was another one. You could have bought Whole Foods for $7 a share in 2009, and it went clear up to $60 a share. Okay?
Wow.
So that's enormous. That's another Chipotle-level smash it out of the park home run. So, yeah. You know...
I mean, it's easy to look back at those things with hindsight, right?
Yeah, of course.
But, I mean, those are companies that I liked a lot at those times. So.
But if we're targeting 26%, then there's lots and lots and lots of examples of this kind of stuff coming off of events. Like, we bought Gildan at net $15 a share after it dropped from 45 on cotton prices going through the roof because of the Egyptian spring and revolutions in the Arab world were affecting cotton prices. And we bought that at $15 a share, and it very quickly went up to $32 where we sold it. And it continued to go on up to 60, which made me feel rather bad about selling it at 32. But it went from 15 to 32 in 9 months.
Wow. Wow.
So, I mean, when you buy in a company at 50% off, you're going to find that it often moves up very rapidly back to its value. Because the event resolves itself. In this case, the event resolved itself very quickly. In the case of BP, for example, that event resolved itself slowly and then unresolved itself through another event. So I bought BP at 27 in this huge, huge problem that it had with this well in the Gulf of Mexico. It had come from 60 down to 27 in a matter of a couple of months, and we bought it hoping it would go lower. But that turned out to be the bottom, and it started going up, and it went all the way back up to $49 a share. So it went from 27 to 49. Now, 54 would have been a full double, right? And then oil started crashing, went from $100 a barrel down to $30 a barrel, and BP went all the way back down to $30 a share. So you can see the value of buying a company at a huge margin of safety price is that even when there's a catastrophe, following the catastrophe, you really are still have a big margin of safety, and it never got down below our basis.
Yeah.
So those are all real world examples.
So to answer Aaron's question, essentially the answer is you got to look super long term. That's the answer.
You got to look long term.
You might go 0000 for years at a time.
Right.
And then, you know, a assuming things go well, you have a big home run on some other years.
Which means, ironically, assuming things suddenly turn into horror shows in the stock market, you're going to get a big home run. And the truth is, the longer that you wait, the longer that the market continues to go up, the more the opportunity that the crash is going to be huge. Understand, there's something called the business cycle that we'll talk about more in another podcast. But there's a long-term debt cycle that corresponds to the business cycle, and that is people borrow money, and the money you borrow and spend is another guy's income. And so if you spend more than you earn by borrowing some $10,000 on your credit card, you just increase some guy's income, let's say from $100,000 to $110,000. And then he can borrow more. He can borrow $11,000. And now he can spend $121,000 instead of $110,000. Or instead of the $100,000 originally, right, before you borrowed any money. And then some other guy can borrow, $20,000. And he can spend $133,000 instead of $100,000. So this cycle spins up. And it usually lasts from peak to peak about between 5 to 8 years. So peak to peak. And then the economy starts to overheat because all of this extra spending above production levels is kicking up incomes and everything's growing too fast. Then the Federal Reserve Bank, the central bank, raises interest rates, makes it more difficult to borrow. Now you have less borrowing, makes it more difficult to repay your loans, makes it more difficult to borrow. Less and less spending happens. Now your non-spending is somebody's non-income, and people have less money, and the cycle works its way back down. Okay, every 5 to 8 years, the stock market is going to go down big time as we go into a recession. So that's something you can basically count on over time as the kind of cycle from peak to peak of roughly 5 to 8 years. So there's going to be a trough in there. In between those two, let's say, eight-year periods, you're gonna have a trough that is the bottom of the market, which is what? 4 years, right? At the longest.
Yeah.
Might be 2.5 or 3. Yeah. So if you can wait 4 years from the peak to the trough, you're going to be in pretty good shape when that trough comes in, where you can buy this stuff, Aaron, and you can buy it cheap enough. It'll make up for 4 years of waiting. That's what I'm saying.
Well, and we've talked before about how right now isn't such a great time to find things on sale, and that at first that really irritated me. But now I'm seeing it as an opportunity to practice my fantasy trading, my paper trading. I like to call it fantasy trading, to practice my my valuations, to do more research, to develop my list of companies that I like a lot that I would buy if they were on sale. And if it were like crashing all around us right now, I wouldn't have the time to do any of that, and I would feel very pushed. I would feel very like not ready. And so in a way, I mean, in kind of perversely non-intuitive way, this is actually giving me the time to practice before one of those down cycles hits.
Yeah, I love it. I kind of think about it like you're building a bunker, to protect you against the missiles that are going to be coming in when the market crashes. There's going to be a lot of fear out there. And if you don't have your bunker built, you're going to get caught up in it. And it's going to be very difficult for you to pull the trigger on Chipotle Grill or pull the trigger on Whole Foods or whatever your, Volkswagen at $10 a share or something. It's going to be really hard to do. You can sit here like an academic, not where nobody's shooting at you and it's all just theoretical, and think, oh yes, I will. But if you have not done the homework, if you have not prepared yourself to know that this is a wonderful company and to know what the on sale price looks like, you're not going to pull the trigger, and you're not going to be able to do what Charlie says to do, which is to load up the truck. That's the skill set, is to load up the truck and get 10% of your hard-earned money into that company at that time.
I think for me, that's where the regular practice element really helps, knowing that I'm doing a little bit every day. And when that time comes, it's not going to feel, because I practice a little bit every day, it's not going to feel like it's like, oh, I've been doing nothing for 6 months and now all of a sudden I'm doing all these things and it's all different. It's like, no, I've been doing a little bit every day. Here's something else that I'm doing today. and I'm going to do some more tomorrow. And every day it might be slightly different, but it's going to happen every day.
Yeah.
And it just smooths out those peaks and valleys in my own emotion about purchasing companies or not purchasing companies, or finding companies that I like or not finding companies that I like. It just smooths out those peaks and valleys by knowing that it's regular and it's going to keep happening every day or every other day, you know, whatever works in your daily schedule.
Well, I think that's huge.
I find it to be a very smoothing practice.
Very cool. I love that. I love that. I'm so happy you feel that way, honey. Honestly, I am. I'm just thrilled that you're finding a kind of a process, a practice. I love your word practice, okay? A practice. And honestly, because you started talking about that, I'm starting to think more and more about what I do as a practice. Because it really doesn't have an end to it. And I'm in something that I really love to do. And the people who do what I do, you know, I think they stay alive longer. I mean, Buffett's extremely mentally active at 86. Charlie Munger at 83, extremely mentally active. Walter Schloss ran his fund till he was 96, successfully, 96 years old. So I love the idea of doing something for the rest of my life as a practice.
Yeah.
And when you have to think about, you must sit quietly now in cash. You know,
when you put it like that, you must sit quietly.
You must sit quietly now.
Treat it as your meditation.
And so, or for me, it's like rowing down the river. In the Grand Canyon, we have long stretches of quiet water and then the occasional really rough big rapid. And it's just the beauty of being in the flow, because it's a practice, right? It's not something you ever perfect. It's always something you're perfecting, and you're always working to be better at it. You're always learning. There's always something to read. There's always something to do. And when you're rowing the river, there's always this flow that you're trying to read that you're comfortable with, but you're a little stroke here. Oh yeah, that's a little better, you know? And then when you get to the big drops, because you're prepared and because you're in the right part of the river and because you've practiced this, they're fun. They're not particularly dangerous or anything. They're fun, you know? So in that context.
You know, the interesting thing, though, is that you've never thought about it when it comes to investing. And that's a sign. And yet you clearly practice every day. There's no question. But to you, it comes so naturally that you've never had to think about it.
I've never thought about it like that.
It's just interesting. You just want to do it. And that's as far as you need to get. Because when something's interesting and you want to do it, you tend to do it. And for the rest of us, we do not find it interesting and we don't want to do it. So we have to think about it a lot more and think about the discipline and think about the process and think about the practice of it. So it's just, it's interesting when you say like how you feel about it and how other people like Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who obviously come to this so naturally, they do this stuff, but they don't talk about it as a practice because they don't feel it as something that requires thought.
I think you're so right. And I think they really feel that there are a relatively small number of people who will take what they're teaching, take what I'm teaching you, and really put it into practice and really do something on a lifetime basis. You know, it's such an individual thing that I don't think they really encourage people to do it. I mean, they say you can do it, but they're not out there saying everybody should do it this way by any means. In fact, Buffett makes the point that his entire fortune is to be invested on after he dies in an index fund. Just stick it in an index fund and forget it. Because,
really?
Yeah, and Ray Dalio, who's one of the best investors in the world, another Transcendental Meditation guy, by the way, who's spoken in Fairfield. Ray Dalio runs Bridgewater, which is the world's largest hedge fund. It's over $100 billion. Has many times said that, you know, when he dies, his fund will be operated in what he calls the all-weather fund, which is a hands-off, rebalanced once a year fund of four buckets that complement each other, but which are non-correlated. So that these...
And it's not actively managed?
And it's not actively managed at all. And that's where his money's going to go for
his
family.
Why are we always doing that?
Well, the main reason is because
stop talking about our practice. Just
well, it's right to the point of Aaron's second question. Actually, he says, "What are we doing with our money while it's sitting, waiting for a great company to come along? Should we be putting it in an index fund?"
Good question, Aaron.
Yeah, and here's the answer. Let's start with Dalio and why he would do what he's doing. He said, first off, he doesn't. You know, he's not that positive that somebody can take these billions of dollars. Okay, remember, he's not working with 10 grand. Yeah. He's working with billions. He's already rich. His family's already rich. There's nowhere they have to go. It's about preservation of capital, okay. Right? Which is a very different thing.
Not about growth.
It is not about growth at all. Yeah. Everybody listening to this podcast who's continuing to listen to it is about growth of capital. There's about 8 million other podcasts out there, and I'll be happy to recommend some to you guys that are all about preservation of capital to diversify across a large number of assets. But unfortunately, for many people, that's not going to do it. That's not going to be enough. You're going to be stuck. If you're young like Danielle, you're going to be stuck as a wage slave to constantly be at the mercy of some company, to have a job, to be able to perform, to be able to get the kids to college, to have a house in a good neighborhood with good schools. All of this constant pressure under somebody else's management, and you may accomplish all the things you want to all the way to age 65 and still have no retirement. That company could go broke and boom, there goes your pension or whatever, right? So taking control of your life financially makes a lot of sense just from a financial point of view, but it makes a lot more sense. And what I love about what's bringing you into a good connection with investing in your own sort of soul is that you're connecting your money with your values and actively performing something that will change the future in some way, in some small way, but the more money you get, in some bigger and bigger way, by putting your money into things that you value. So,
yeah, exactly. And so what, as I'm sitting here doing my practice, as I'm learning, as I'm working on finding companies that match my values, what should I do with my money in the meantime?
So Aaron said, you know, should I try to go get 5 to 7% on average in this index fund? And I would say the first thing is that the key to being able to load up the truck, Aaron, when you have this wonderful company that's on sale finally, right? The market finally crashes and now it's on sale. The key to being able to take advantage of that is that you have cash. So if you've put your money in an index fund, your money just crashed with the market and you are screwed.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Now you don't have anything to buy. You know, your index fund went down 50% in 2009. Now what are you going to do? Okay, yeah, you're going to pull out half of it because that's all that's left and buy Chipotle. Great, but what happened to the other half? And all of a sudden,
talk about your overall rate of return that we just talked about.
You just blew up your overall rate of return. Totally. So,
what else could you do, though?
Well, here's what I recommend people do at our workshop. And I don't, you know, I'm not plugging the workshop because it fills up every single month. But just so you'll know, there is a way to invest in indexes, in broad market indexes, that as we've been pretty successful with in the past at exiting those indexes as the market is starting to tank. It involves a little more action, but
yeah,
you gotta get involved.
Like technical indicators and all that stuff.
I am indeed. And I don't recommend that until you really learn how to do it. So if you don't know how to do that properly, then you really don't have much choice other than to stay in cash. That's it.
Yeah, that's just a whole, I mean, like, I get that some people, maybe that's appropriate for if they're watching it every day. I'm not watching it every day. I mean, to me, that's the whole point of this whole thing, is to come up with a way to not be watching things every day, to come up with a way that where I'm looking really long term. Yes, I'm doing my practice every day, but it doesn't involve checking what's happening on a day-to-day basis in like a kind of like nervous, like gotta avoid the drop kind of feeling to it.
Well, I don't think you have to do it every day, but you certainly have to be much, much more active, and timing becomes important. And this isn't something for everybody. And the only reason we teach it at the workshop is because many of the people who come to the workshop have 401ks at the company they work at, and those 401k programs only allow the mutual funds and indexes. So because of that, we teach it. But if you don't if you're not stuck in indexes and 401ks,
that's a lot of people though. A lot of people have 401ks.
Yeah, it is a lot of people, which is why we teach it. But in this particular case, Aaron apparently has the ability to be either in an index or cash, and then invest in individual stocks. My recommendation is you stay in a money market account that pays a little pittance, and you have your money liquid to get it when you need it, and don't put it in something that's going to crash with the market, so that you're ready to go and pull the trigger when the time comes.
That's how I would go. Does cash mean in your checking account or in your investment account with your brokerage?
Yeah, it's in your brokerage account, and you can put it into something that'll deliver a money market rate of return, I think, in most brokerage accounts. So we'll get to more of his question later. I think that's enough for right now. Obviously, if this is interesting to you and you like getting your questions answered, write us at questions@investedpodcast.com.
Look at you. You remembered our email address.
I know. Pretty good. Huh? investedpodcast.com. Okay. Not rule1investing.com.
If you want to find out about the workshop, go to investedpodcast.com. There will be a link to it.
Yeah.
And we will finish up Aaron's question next time.
Yep, we'll do. So until then, time to go play.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.